Chapter 20. Frank's Own Story. Frank took the stand himself Monday afternoon, and with his life at stake, made the most remarkable statement ever uttered in a criminal courtroom in Georgia. It was so impressive that it brought many to the belief that he was incapable and innocent of the crime charged against him. Frank began his statement at 5 minutes after 2 o'clock. He finished 4 hours later, at 5 minutes after six. He talked with three brief intermissions. Twice he was interrupted by Solicitor Dorsey, who objected to the exhibition to the jury of articles not entered in evidence, and once he stopped for a drink of water. When he finished, his voice was clear as at the commencement of the ordeal. With his last sentences, he held his auditors breathless. "A newspaper man," he said, "called me the silent man in the tower. I was silent because my counsel advised me to be. They told me to wait until the proper time to tell my story. This is the place. The hour is here. And, gentlemen, I have told you the truth and the whole truth." At any other time, in any other place, the conclusion would have been melodramatic. Here it was simply the final appeal of a man pleading for his life. An eloquent appeal. There was absolute silence in the courtroom for perhaps 10 seconds when Frank finished. Then the stillness was broken almost simultaneously by the sobbing of Mrs. Leo Frank and the laconic command of Attorney Arnold. "Come down." The accused man stepped from the stand with just as much self-possession and just as sprightly a step as he had walked upon it 4 hours before. Whatever may have been the strain on his mentality, there was no physical sign to reflect it. He resumed his seat between his wife and mother. The younger woman threw her arms around him and sobbed on his shoulder. He tried to comfort her with tender affection. The mother took her son's head in her hands and kissed him passionately again and again. She too cried, but did not break down as did the wife, who was still convulsed when Frank was led away by the sheriff to his quarters in the tower. Where some men with their life in the balance would be nervous, Leo Frank was cool and in complete control of all his faculties. Where some men would have been overcome, he talked with the simplicity he would have employed in a commonplace conversation. Where some men's minds would have been chaotic, he performed complex mathematical problems in his brain. Beginning with his birth in Paris, Texas, he reviewed his life briefly. He told of attending school in Brooklyn, of going through college. He told of the organization of the National Pencil Company, and of a trip to Europe to study the manufacture of pencils. He told of his life in Atlanta. "The days since I married have been the happiest of my life," he said. Without a trace of hesitancy, he told of his actions on the day he is alleged to have murdered Mary Fagan. Calmly, he flatly contradicted the statements of Jim Connolly, the Negro, whose sworn statement has placed him so close to the gallows. "The statement of Connolly is a tissue of lies. I know nothing about the death of the little girl, and the accusation that I called him to help dispose of the body is a monstrous lie. The statement that he saw me with women in an unnatural position is a lie so vile that I have no words to denounce it. I have no wealthy relatives in Brooklyn. My father is an invalid, and he and my mother have only enough to live moderately on. There is no fund for my defense. My attorneys will be paid by the disposal of a portion of the estate of my parents." Just as coolly, he contradicted the sworn evidence of C.B. Dalton. "The statement that two women came into my office for immoral purposes is a base lie." During the recounting of his story, Frank stepped from the stand to explain the work of preparing the weekly financial sheet of the factory, part of his circumstantial alibi. Laying his papers on the rail, which fronts the jury box, he addressed the 12 men who can send him to death if they so will, with just the same earnestness one can imagine him addressing a buyer over his desk in the factory of the National Pencil Company. He discussed the figures and went through the computations as intelligently as if he did not have the weight of his life upon his shoulders. On Saturday, April 26th, I rose between 7 and 7:30 and leisurely washed and dressed, had my breakfast, caught a Washington Street or Georgia Avenue car, I don't know which, at the corner of Washington Street and Georgia Avenue, and arrived at the factory on Forsyth Street, the Forsyth Street plant, at about 8:30. That is my recollection. On my arrival at the factory, I found Mr. Holloway, the day watchman, at his usual place, and I greeted him in my usual way. I found Alonzo Mann, the office boy, in the outer office. I took off my coat and hat and opened my desk and opened the safe and assorted the various books and files and wire trays containing the various papers that were placed there the evening before and distributed them in their proper places about the office. I should figure about 9:15 a.m., a quarter after nine, Miss Mattie Smith came in and asked me for her pay envelope, and for that of her sister-in-law, and I went to the safe and unlocked it, and got out the package of envelopes that Mr. Schiff had given me the evening before, and gave her the required two envelopes, and placed the remaining envelopes that I got out, that were left over from the day previous, in my cash box, where I would have them handy in case others might come in, and I wanted to have them near at hand without having to jump up and go to the safe every time in order to get them. I keep my cash box in the lower drawer on the left-hand side of my desk. Mr. Darley left with me to Montag's about 9:35 or 9:40, when we passed out of the factory and stopped at the corner of Hunter and Forsyth Streets, where we each had a drink at Cruikshank's soda water fount, where I bought a package of favorite cigarettes. And after we had our drink, we conversed together there for some time, and I lighted a cigarette and told him good-bye as he went in one direction, and I went on my way then to Montag Brothers, where I arrived, as nearly as may be, at 10 o'clock or a little after. On entering Montag Brothers, I spoke to Mr. Sig Montag, the general manager of the business. I spoke to Miss Hattie Hall, the pencil company's stenographer, who stays at Montag Brothers, and asked her to come over and help me that morning. Frank explained here the work awaiting him for which he needed help. I returned to Forsyth Street alone. On arrival at Forsyth Street, I went to the second or office floor, and I noticed the clock, and it indicated 5 minutes after 11 o'clock. I saw Mr. Holloway there, and I told him he could go as soon as he got ready. I then went into the office. I went in the outer office and found Miss Hattie Hall, who had preceded me over from Montag's, and another lady who introduced herself to me as Mrs. Arthur White, and the office boy. Mrs. Arthur White wanted to see her husband. It was about this time that I heard the elevator motor start up and the circular saw in the carpenter shop, which is right next to it, running. I heard it saw through some boards, which I supposed was the work that Mr. Holloway had referred to. It was about this time that Mrs. Emma Clark Freeman and Miss Corinthia Hall, two of the girls who worked on the fourth floor, came in and asked permission to go upstairs and get Mrs. Freeman's coat, which I readily gave, and I told them at the same time to tell Arthur White that his wife was downstairs. A short time after they left my office, two gentlemen came in, one of them a Mr. Graham, and the other the father of a boy by the name of Earl Burdett. These two boys had gotten into some sort of trouble during the noon recess the day before, and were taken down to police headquarters, and of course didn't get their envelopes the night before. and I gave the required pay envelopes to the two fathers and chatted with them at some length in reference to the trouble their boys had gotten into the day previous. And just before they left the office, Mrs. Emma Clark Freeman came into my office and asked permission to use the telephone. I got Miss Hattie Hall and dictated what mail I had to give her. Miss Hall finished the work and started to leave when the 12 o'clock whistle blew. She left the office and returned, it looked to me, almost immediately, calling into my office that she had forgotten something, and then she left for good. Here Frank gave a long explanation of the pencil factory method of transcribing orders. To the best of my knowledge, it must have been from 10 to 15 minutes after Miss Hall left my office when this little girl, whom I afterwards found to be Mary Fagan, entered my office and asked for her pay envelope. I asked for her number, and she told me. I went to the cash box and took her envelope out and handed it to her, identifying the envelope by the number. She left my office and apparently had gotten as far as the door from my office leading to the outer office, when she evidently stopped and asked me if the metal had arrived, and I told her no. She continued on her way out, and I heard the sound of her footsteps as she went away. It was a few moments after she asked me this question that I had an impression of a female voice saying something. I don't know which way it came from, just passed away, and I had that impression. This little girl had evidently worked in the metal department by her question, and had been laid off owing to the fact that some metal that had been ordered had not arrived at the factory, hence her question. I only recognized this little girl from having seen her around the plant, and did not know her name, simply identifying her envelope from her having called her number to me. She had left the plant hardly 5 minutes when Lemmy Quinn, the foreman of the plant, came in and told me that I could not keep him away from the factory, even though it was a holiday, at which I smiled and kept on working. He first asked me if Mr. Schiff had come down, and I told him he had not, and he turned around and left. I continued to work until I finished this work and these requisitions, and I looked at my watch and noticed that it was 1:45. I called my home up on the telephone, for I knew that my wife and my mother-in-law were going to the matinee, and I wanted to know when they would have lunch. I got my house, and Manola answered the phone and said that they would have lunch immediately and for me to come right on home. I then gathered my papers together and went upstairs to see the boys on the top floor. This must have been, since I had just looked at my watch, 1:50. I noticed in the evidence of one of the witnesses, Mrs. Arthur White, she states it was 12:35 that she passed by and saw me. That is possibly true. I have no recollection about it. Perhaps her recollection is better than mine. I have no remembrance of it. However, I expect it is so. When I arrived upstairs, I saw Arthur White and Harry Denham, who had been working up there, and Mr. White's wife. I asked them if they were ready to go, and they said they had laid out some work, and I had to see what work they had done and were going to do. I asked Mr. White's wife if she was going or would stay there, as I would be obliged to lock up the factory, and Mrs. White said no, she would go then. I went down and gathered up my papers and locked my desk, and went around and washed my hands and put on my hat and coat, and locked the inner door to my office, and locked the doors to the streets, and started to go home. Now, gentlemen, to the best of my recollection, from the time the whistle blew for 12 o'clock until after 1:45, when I went upstairs and spoke to Arthur White and Harry Denham, I did not stir out of the inner office. But it is possible that in order to answer a call of nature I may have gone to the toilet. Those are things that a man does unconsciously, and cannot tell how many times nor when he does it. Now, sitting in my office at my desk, it is impossible for me to see out into the outer hall when the safe door is open, as it was that morning, And not only is it impossible for me to see out, but it is impossible for people to see in and see me there. Frank told here of his trip home, his dinner, and his return to the factory. I unlocked the street door, and then unlocked the inner door and left it open, and went on upstairs to tell the boys that I had come back, and wanted to know if they were ready to go. At that time they were preparing to leave. I went immediately down to my office and opened the safe and my desk and hung up my coat and hat and started to work on the financial report, which I will explain. Mr. Schiff had not come down, and there was additional work for me to do. In a few minutes after I started to work on the financial sheet, which I am going to take up in a few minutes, I heard the bell ring on the time clock outside, and Arthur White and Harry Denham came into the office. And Arthur White borrowed $2 from me in advance on his wages. I had gotten to work on the financial sheet, figuring it out, when I happened to go out to the lavatory, and on returning to the office, the door pointed out directly in front. I noticed Newt Lee, the watchman, coming from toward the head of the stairs, coming toward me. I looked at the clock, and I had told him the night before to come back at 4 o'clock, for I expected to go to the baseball game. At that time, Newt Lee came along and greeted me, and offered me a banana out of a yellow bag which he carried, which I presume contained bananas. I declined the banana, and I told him that I had no way of letting him know how long I was going to be there, at work, and that I had changed my mind about going to the ball game. I told him that he could go if he saw fit for an hour and a half, but to be sure and be back by 6:30 p.m. He went off down the staircase leading out, and I returned to my office. Now, in reference to Newt Lee, the watchman, the first night he came there to watch, I personally took him around the plant, first, second, and third floors, and into the basement, and told him that he would be required, that it was his duty, to go over the entire building every half hour, not only to completely tour the upper four floors, but to go down to the basement. And I especially stressed the point that the dust bin along there was one of the most dangerous places for a fire, and I wanted him to be sure and go back there every half hour, and to be careful how he held his lantern. I told him it was a part of his duty to look after and lock that back door, and he fully understood it, and I showed him the cutoff for the electric current, and told him in case of fire that ought to be pulled so no fireman coming in would be electrocuted. I explained everything to him in detail, and told him that he was to make that tour every half hour and stamp it on the time card, and that that included the basement of the building. Frank, at this point, gave an elaborate explanation of the financial sheet and his Saturday afternoon's work. I finished this work that I have just outlined at about 5 minutes to 6, and I proceeded to take out the clock strips from the clock, which were used that day, and replace them. I won't show you these slips. But the slips that I put in that night were stamped with a blue ink with a rubber dating stamp, April 28th, at the bottom, opposite the word date. He explained the time slips. As I was putting these time slips into the clock, as mentioned, I saw Newt Lee coming up the stairs. It was as near as may be 6 o'clock. I finished putting in the slip and went back to wash up, and as I was washing, I heard Newt Lee ring the bell on the clock when he registered his first punch for the night, and he went downstairs to the front door to wait my departure. After washing, I went down the stairs. I put on my hat and coat and went downstairs to the front door. As I opened the front door, I saw outside on the street side of the door, Newt Lee in conversation with Mr. J. M. Gant, a man that I had let go from the office 2 weeks previous. They seemed to be in discussion, and Newt Lee told me that Mr. Gant wanted to go back up into the office, and he had refused him admission, because his instructions were for no one to go back into the factory after he went out, unless he got contrary instructions from Mr. Darley or myself. I spoke to Mr. Gant, and asked him what he wanted. He said he had a couple pairs of shoes, a black pair and a tan pair, in the shipping room. I told Newt it would be all right to pass Gant in, and Gant went in, Newt Lee closing the door and locking it after him. I heard the bolt turn in the door. I then walked up Forsyth Street to Alabama, down Alabama to Broad Street, where I posted two letters, one to my uncle, Mr. M. Frank, and one to Mr. Pappenheimer, a few minutes after six, and continued on my way down to Jacob's Whitehall and Alabama Street store, where I went in and got a drink at the soda fountain and bought my wife a box of candy. I then caught the Georgia Avenue car and arrived home by about 6:25. Frank told of calling up Newt Lee and detailed an ordinary evening at home until he retired at 11 o'clock. The next day, Sunday, April 27th, I was awakened at something before 7 o'clock by the telephone ringing. I got out of bed, put on a bathrobe, and went down to answer the telephone, and a man's voice spoke to me over the phone and said, I afterwards found out this man that spoke to me was City Detective Starnes. Is this Mr. Frank, superintendent of the National Pencil Company? I says, yes, sir. He says, I want you to come down to the factory right away. I says, what's the trouble? Has there been a fire? He says, no, a tragedy. I want you to come down right away. I says, all right. He says, I'll send an automobile for you. I says, all right, and hung up and went upstairs to dress. I was in the midst of dressing to go with the people who should come for me in the automobile. When the automobile drove up, the bell rang, and my wife went downstairs to answer the door. She had on just a nightdress with a robe over it. I followed my wife. I wasn't completely dressed at that time, didn't have my trousers or shirt on, and as soon as I could get together, get my trousers and shirt on, I went downstairs, following my wife in a minute or two. I asked them what the trouble was, and the man who I afterwards found out was Detective Black hung his head and didn't say anything. Now, at this point, these two witnesses, Mr. Rogers and Mr. Black, differ with me on the place where the conversation occurred. I say, to the best of my recollection, it occurred right there in the house, in front of my wife. They say it occurred just as I left the house, in the automobile. But be that as it may, this is the conversation. They asked me, did I know Mary Fagan? I told them I didn't. They then said to me, didn't a little girl with long hair hanging down her back come up to your office yesterday sometime for her money? A little girl who works in the tipping plant? I said, yes, I do remember such a girl coming up to my office. I didn't know her name was Mary Fagan. Well, we want you to come down with us to the factory. And I finished dressing, and as they had said they would bring me right back, I didn't have breakfast, but went right on with them, in the automobile. Made the trip to the undertaking establishment very quickly. I mean, they made the trip downtown very quickly. And stopped at the corner of Mitchell and Pryor Streets. They told me they were going to take me to the undertaker's first, that they wanted me to see the body and see if I could identify the little girl. I went with them to the undertaking establishment, and one of the two men asked the attendant to show us the way into where the body was, and the attendant went down a long, dark passageway with Mr. Rogers following. Then I came, and Black brought up the rear. We walked down this long passageway until we got to a place that was apparently the door to a small room. Very dark in there. The attendant went in and suddenly switched on the electric light, and I saw the body of the little girl. Mr. Rogers walked in the room and stood to my right, inside of the room. I stood right in the door, leaning up against the right facing of the door, and Mr. Black was to the left, leaning on the left facing, but a little to my rear, and the attendant, whose name I have since learned was Mr. Giesling, was on the opposite side of the little cooling table to where I stood. In other words, the little table was between him and me. He removed a cloth, and there was a deep scratch over the left eye on the forehead. About the neck there was twine, a piece of cord similar to that which is used at the pencil factory, and also a piece of white rag. After looking at the body, I identified that little girl as the one that had been up shortly after noon the day previous and got her money from me. We then left the undertaking establishment, got in the automobile, and rode over to the pencil factory. Frank told here of the trip through the factory. Now, gentlemen, I have heard a great deal, and so have you, in this trial, about nervousness, about how nervous I was that morning. Gentlemen, I was nervous. I was very nervous. I was completely unstrung. I will admit it. Imagine, awakened out of my sound sleep, and a run in the cool of the morning in an automobile driven at top speed, without any food or breakfast, rushing into a dark passageway, coming into a darkened room, and then suddenly an electric light flashed on, and to see the sight that was presented by that poor little child. Why, it was a sight that was enough to drive a man to distraction. That was a sight that would have made a stone melt. And then, it is suspicious, because a man who is ordinary flesh and blood should show signs of nervousness. Just imagine that little girl, in the first blush of young womanhood, had had her life so cruelly snuffed out. Might a man not be nervous who looked at such a sight? Of course I was nervous. Any man would be nervous if he was a man. Frank told here of the trip to the police station, and then of his return to his home. After dinner I read a little while, and finally caught the 10 minutes of 3 Georgia Avenue car going downtown. I got off at the corner of Pryor and Mitchell Streets, and went into the undertaker, Bloomfield's, where I saw a large crowd of people nearby on the outside. On entering, I found quite a number of people who were working at the pencil factory, among whom were Mr. Schiff, Herbert Schiff, N. V. Darley, Wade Campbell, Alonzo Mann, Mr. Spilter, and Mr. Vigency. I chatted with them a few minutes, and I noticed that the people who were going in to see the body were standing in line and moving in, and that others from the factory were going in, and I thought I would go in too and pay my respects. I went and stood in line and went into the room again, and stayed a few minutes in the mortuary chamber. The little girl had been cleaned up. Her hair had all been cleaned and smoothed out, and there was a nice white sheet over the rest of her body. I returned to the front of the undertaking establishment and stood chatting with Herbert Schiff and Mr. Darley until the party with whom we had made the arrangements came up, and we gave them the keys with instructions as to watching the plant that night. Then Mr. Darley and Mr. Schiff and myself went down to police headquarters and went up into Chief Lanford's office, and the three of us stood talking there, answering all sorts of questions that not only Chief Lanford but the other detectives would shoot at us. And finally Mr. Darley said he would like to talk to Newt Lee. Then he went into another room, and I presume they brought Newt Lee up from the cell so he could talk to him. When Newt Lee was gone, the detective showed us the 2 notes and the pad with a few unused leaves to it, and the pencil that they claimed they had found down in the basement near the body. Frank cited vain attempts to decipher the notes, of leaving, passing by the pencil factory, where they saw a morbid crowd, and of returning home. He told of going to the police station Monday, and of interviewing detectives there. He also told of being taken to the pencil factory and shown blood spots on the floor of the metal room. Frank told here of retaining Harry Scott. He also told of his actions on Tuesday when he was arrested at the pencil factory and taken to the police station. It was about this time they took me from upstairs to the sergeant's desk, and Detective Starnes, John M. Starnes, I think his name is, came in and dictated from the original notes that were found near the body to me to get a sample of my handwriting. They took me then to a room on top of the building, and I sat in the room there and either read magazines or newspapers and talked to my friends who came to see me until I was to retire at midnight. I had the cover of my cot turned back, and I was going to bed when Detective Scott and Detective Black at midnight, Tuesday, April 29th, came in and said, "Mr. Frank, we would like to talk to you a little bit. Come in and talk to us." I said, "Sure, I will be only too glad to." I went with them to a little room on the top floor of the headquarters. In that room was Detective Scott, and Detective Black, and myself. They stressed the possibility of couples having been led into the factory at night by the night watchman, Newt Lee. I told them I didn't know anything about it, that if I had, I certainly would have put a stop to it long ago. They said, "Mr. Frank, you have never talked alone with Newt Lee. You are his boss, and he respects you. See what you can do with him. We can't get anything more out of him. See if you can." I says, "All right, I understand what you mean. I will do my best," because I was only too willing to help. Black says, "Now put it strong to him, and tell him to cough up and tell all he knows. Tell him that you are here, and that he is here, and that he better open up and tell all he knows about happenings at the pencil factory that Saturday night, or you will both go to hell." Those were the detective's exact words. I told Mr. Black I caught his meaning, and in a few minutes afterwards, Detective Starnes brought up Newt Lee from the cell room. They put Newt Lee into a room and handcuffed him to a chair. I spoke to him at some length in there, but I couldn't get anything additional out of him. He said he knew nothing about couples coming in there at night, and remembering the instructions Mr. Black had given me, I said, "Now, Newt, you are here, and I am here, and you'd better open up and tell all you know, and tell the truth and the full truth, because you will get us both into lots of trouble if you don't tell all you know." And he answered me like an old negro, "Before God, Mr. Frank, I am telling you the truth, and I have told you all I know." And the conversation ended right there. Within a minute or two afterwards, the detectives came back into the room, that is, Detective Scott and Detective Black, and then began questioning Newt Lee. And then it was that I had my first initiation into the third degree of the Atlanta Police Department. The way that fellow Black cursed to that poor old negro, Newt Lee, was something awful. He shrieked at him, he hollered at him, he cursed and did everything but beat him. Then they took Newt Lee down to a cell, and I went to my cot in the outer room. Now, before closing my statement, I wish to touch upon a couple of insinuations and accusations, other than the one on the bill of indictment, that have been leveled against me so far during the trial. The first is this, the fact that I would not talk to the detectives, that I would not see Jim Conley. Well, let's look into the facts a few minutes and see whether there was any reason for that, or if there be any truth in that statement. On Monday morning I was taken down to the undertaking establishment, to the factory, and I went to the headquarters. I went to headquarters the second time, going there willingly, without anybody coming for me. On each occasion, I answered them frankly and unreservedly, giving them the benefit of the best of my knowledge, answering all and any of their questions, and discussing the matter generally with them. On Monday, they came for me again. I went down and answered any and all of their questions, and gave them a statement which they took down in writings, because I thought it was right, and I was only too glad to do it. I answered them and told them all that I knew, answering all questions. Tuesday I was down at police station again, and answered every question, and discussed the matter freely and openly with them. Midnight was the time they chose to talk to me. But even at such an outlandish hour, I was still willing to help them. And at their instigation, I spoke to Newt Lee alone. But what was the result? They commenced, and they grilled that poor negro, and put words into his mouth that I never said, and twisted not alone the English, but distorted my meaning. I just decided then and there that if that was the line of conduct they were going to pursue, I would wash my hands of them. I didn't want to have anything to do with them. On the afternoon of May 1st, I was taken to the Fulton County Tower. On May 3rd, Detectives Black and Scott came up to my cell in the tower and wanted to speak to me alone without any of my friends around. I said, all right. I wanted to hear what they had to say that time. Then Block tore off something like this. Mr. Frank, we are suspicious of that man Darley. We are watching him. We have been shadowing him. Now open up and tell us what you know about him. I said, gentlemen, you have come to the wrong man, because Mr. Darley is the soul of honor and is as true as steel. He would not do a crime like that. He couldn't do it. And Black chirped up, come on, Scott, nothing doing. And off they go. That showed me how much reliance could be placed in either the city detectives or our own Pinkerton detectives. And I treated such conduct with silence, and it was for this reason, gentlemen, that I didn't see Conley, surrounded with a bevy of city detectives and Mr. Scott, because I knew that there would not be an action so trifling, that there was not an action so natural, but that they would distort and twist it to be used against me. Frank denied here the implication that he knew Conley could write and didn't tell the authorities. The statement of the witness Dalton, he continued, is utterly false as far as coming to my office and being introduced to me by the woman Daisy Hopkins is concerned. If Dalton was ever in the factory building with any woman, I didn't know it. I never saw Dalton in my life to know him until this crime. In reply to the statement of Miss Irene Jackson, she is wholly mistaken in supposing I ever went to a lady's dressing room for the purpose of making improper glances into the girl's dressing room. I have no recollection of occasions of which she speaks, but I do know that that lady's dressing room on the fourth floor is a mere room in which the girls change their outer clothing. There was no bath or toilet in that room, and it had windows opening onto the street. There was no lock on the door, and I know I never went into that room at any hour when the girls were dressing. These girls were supposed to be at their work at 7 o'clock. Occasionally I've had reports that the girls were flirting from this dressing room, through the windows, with men. It is also true that sometimes the girls would loiter in this room when they ought to have been doing their work. It is possible that on some occasions I looked into this room to see if the girls were doing their duty, and were not using this room as a place for loitering and for flirting. These girls were not supposed to be dressing in that room after 7 o'clock, and I know that I never looked into that room at any hour when I had any reason to suppose they were dressing. Gentlemen, I know nothing whatever of the death of little Mary Fagan. I had no part in causing her death, nor do I know how she came to her death after she took her money and left my office. I never even saw Conley in the factory or anywhere else on that date, April 26, 1913. The statement of the negro Conley is a tissue of lies from first to last. I know nothing whatever of the cause of the death of Mary Fagan, and Conley's statement as to his coming up and helping me dispose of the body, or that I had anything to do with her or to do with him that day, is a monstrous lie. The story as to women coming into the factory with me for immoral purposes is a base lie, and the few occasions that he claims to have seen me in indecent positions with women is a lie so vile that I have no language with which to fitly denounce it. I have no rich relative in Brooklyn, New York. My father is an invalid. My father and mother together are people of very limited means, who have barely enough to live on. My father is not able to work. I have no relative who has any means at all, except Mr. M. Frank, who lives in Atlanta, Georgia. Nobody has raised a fund to pay the fees of my attorneys. These fees have been paid by the sacrifice, in part, of the small property which my parents possess. Gentlemen, some newspaper men have called me the silent man in the tower, and I kept my silence and my counsel advisedly until the proper time and place. The time is now, the place is here, and I have told you the truth, the whole truth." The court was still as Frank left the stand. With the statement of the defendant, the state rested its case. Tuesday morning, Solicitor General Dorsey opened in rebuttal. He first attacked the character of Daisy Hopkins. Numerous witnesses said that she had borne an unsavory reputation during and following the time she was employed at the factory. A streetcar motorman declared that he had visited her room by appointment one night, and that she had showed him teeth marks on various parts of her body. The girl told him that her foreman had bitten her, the witness stated. A youth who had been employed in the factory for a few weeks, several months prior to the murder, declared that he had seen Frank talking to Mary on one occasion. The witness stated that the conversation had taken place in the metal room near the little girl's machine. He had heard Frank remark to her, "You've got to talk to me. I'm the superintendent of this factory." This was in reply, he said, to a remark of the girl that she must get to work. On Tuesday, the state made a determined effort to prove that Frank was not of good character. A severe blow was struck when Judge Roan ruled, after an hour or more of argument between the opposing counsel, that the state could not introduce specific acts of misconduct against the defendant. As far as the court would permit him to go, was to put the girls whom the state declared were willing to testify that Frank had made indecent proposals to them on the stand to testify that the accused was of bad character. This disheartened the state, but nearly a score of girls were called during the day who declared that Frank's character for lasciviousness was bad. Miss Mertice Cato was the first of these witnesses called. "Are you acquainted with the general character of Leo M. Frank prior to and including April 26, 1913? Asked the prosecutor. "Yes." "Was that character good or bad?"
"Bad."
"Did you ever work at the National Pencil Factory?"
"Yes."
"When did you stop work there?"
"On April 28th.
"How long did you work there?"
3.5 years.
"What floor did you work on?"
"The fourth floor."
"She is with you, gentlemen," said the solicitor, turning to the attorneys for the defense, he having exhausted the questions allowed him by law.
"Come down," said Attorney Rosser. The defense thus refused to cross-examine these witnesses. As it was impossible for the state to get the testimony before the jury direct, and the defense refused, the 12 jurymen were left in ignorance as to how serious that evidence might have been, had it been brought out. Miss Maggie Griffin was the next witness. She testified in answer to the same questions that she knew the general character of Frank and that it was bad. She said that she worked at the factory for 2.5 months, and that she worked on the fourth floor. Solicitor Dorsey paused a moment, and Attorney Rosser, in a low tone, asked the witness, "When did you quit work at the factory?" She answered that she quit in February.
"Wait a minute," said Solicitor Dorsey. "I'm not through yet."
"I beg your pardon," said Attorney Rosser. "I thought you had finished."
"Now," said the solicitor, "I am going to ask you a question, and I don't want you to answer it until the judge tells you whether you can answer it or not. Are you acquainted with the general character of Leo M. Frank as to his relations with women?" Immediately there was an objection from Attorney Rosser.
Dorsey contended that the testimony of the defense's witness put in issue the specific phase of Frank's character. The jury was sent out. Attorney Rosser insisted that the state could not show anything but general character. "I thought," said he, "that your honor had ruled to that effect already." Solicitor Dorsey replied by saying, "Your honor ruled that we could not show specific instances, and to that ruling we submit. This, however, is a different proposition. The statement by the defendant to the jury that he never had women in his office put that phase of his character in issue. Now, Your Honor, continued the solicitor, while the jury is out, I want to show by this witness that she saw Frank go into the dressing room on the fourth floor with one of the four ladies, and that no one else was in there at the time. Attorney Rosser objected strenuously. Solicitor Dorsey continued, Certainly, Your Honor, we are entitled to show that one of the very witnesses of the defense who testified that she knew of no wrong conduct on the part of the defendant, and that she had never been guilty of wrong conduct with him, was seen by this witness to go into the dressing room with him on the fourth floor. Judge Roan, are you offering this testimony in rebuttal to the testimony of the lady you speak of? Solicitor Dorsey, yes, sir, that's exactly the way we are offering it. Attorney Rosser objected on the ground that the testimony of their witness, to wit, the women who work on the fourth floor, was offered in rebuttal to the testimony of James Conley. Judge Roan, I rule, Mr. Dorsey, that if you undertake to show a distinct crime, the testimony will not be admissible. But if you offer the testimony in contradiction to the testimony of one of the witnesses for the defense, I think you can put it in. Also, I am inclined to think that you can show the defendant's character as to his relations with women. Attorney Rosser met the ruling with the demand that before the solicitor could offer the testimony as a contradiction of the defense witness must first be put back on the stand by the solicitor for cross-examination. This demand was based on his contention that the defense witness had testified to conduct in Frank's office. All right, said the solicitor. Bring in Miss Rebecca Carson. The jury returned to the courtroom. Miss Griffin continued on the stand. Do you know the general character of Leo M. Frank as to his attitude toward women? Yes, I do. What is it? Bad. Under cross-examination by Attorney Rosser. How long did you work at the factory?
2 months.
What floor?
Fourth.
Whom did you know there?
The witness named several young women.
What did you do when you left the factory?
I didn't work for 2 months, and then I went to the cotton mills.
Where do you live?
84 Evans Drive, Fort McPherson.
This concluded the cross-examination, and Solicitor Dorsey recalled Miss Mertice Cato. The solicitor asked Miss Cato if she knew Frank's general character as to his relations with women, and she replied, No. She was asked by Attorney Rosser where she works now. She replied, Cone's Drug Store. In reply to other questions, she said she lives at 59 Tumland Street and that she worked in the factory for over 3 years. Mrs. R. M. Dunnigan was the next witness. She answered the solicitor's questions, saying that she knew Frank's general character and that it was bad. In reply to the question as to whether or not she knew of Frank's relations with women, she said no. The witness stated that she worked at the factory 2 years ago for 2 or 3 weeks. At that time, she said, she was 14 years old. She was excused without cross-examination. Mrs. H. J. Johnson of Stonewall, Georgia, was called. Mrs. Johnson said she worked at the pencil factory 2 months during 1910. She said Frank's general reputation was bad. Asked if she knew of his relations with women, she said, Not very much. The court held that the solicitor could ask no further questions. Many women followed in rapid succession. The defense neglected to cross-examine all, except to ask their addresses. One of the women, according to Solicitor Dorsey, was ready to testify that Frank had made an indecent proposal to her in his private office, and that she had brought a monkey wrench into use before she escaped from the room. Another, the solicitor asserted, would tell of a lascivious proposal made by Frank, which indicated that he was abnormal. Miss Dewey Hewell,
who was brought to Atlanta from the home of the Good Shepherd in Cincinnati, especially to testify, said that Frank had known Mary Fagan and that she had seen him in conversation with her. How often would he talk to her? The witness was asked.
Sometimes two or three times a day.
What did you see him do?
I saw him put his hand on her shoulder.
Did he do anything else?
No, sir, I didn't see him do anything else.
Did he call her by any name? And if so, what?
Yes, sir, he called her Mary.
Where did he stand when he talked to her?
He would stand close to her.
Wednesday afternoon, August 20th, both sides rested. The introduction of sub-rebuttal evidence took but little more than an hour in the afternoon, and the state had finished its rebuttal soon after the noon recess. The testimony of witnesses who had figured in the time alibi of Frank was attacked, as well as that of the physicians who refuted the evidence of Doctors Harris and Hurt. Nathan Sinkovitz, a pawnbroker, swore that M. E. McCoy, who earlier in the trial had testified to seeing Mary Fagan on her way to the pencil factory at about 12 o'clock on the day of the murder, had pawned his watch with him in January, and that the timepiece had remained in his possession until August. Others refuted the statements of the streetcar men that Mary had not been accompanied by little George Epps when she came to town on the fatal day.